Good afternoon, everyone. We have four speakers scheduled, although I understand that there may be a slight change in the program later on, but we'll let you know in good time. At any rate, our first speaker this afternoon is Fred Espenak, and I guess, in a way, he's really the one who doesn't need any introduction. But let me just say that although his work at Goddard Space Center at NASA is in the planetary division as an astrophysicist, the thing that is really interesting is that all this work he's done over the years in developing the eclipse bulletins and the tandem of solar eclipses and so on has really been amateur work. And we owe him a great deal for all the work he's done over the years. Anyway, today what he's going to do is talk about the eclipse predictions for 2005 and beyond. Right? Okay, good one.
Thanks very much, Ralph. If you can have a light down, you're in front of me. I'm going to talk about future eclipses primarily, but before we look forward, I couldn't resist a little look back at some of the major events of the past 2 years. In May of 2003, there was an annular eclipse that passed through northern Scotland and Iceland. I traveled up to Iceland for that eclipse with a small group. And we had some interesting weather, gorgeous weather in Iceland, for the 3 days before the eclipse. And about 18 hours before the eclipse, I saw cirrus clouds moving through. And they built up through the afternoon, and we frantically were looking at maps and trying to figure out which way the front was moving and calling the airport and speaking to the meteorological office and trying to scope out what the best strategy was. And we ended up going to the place we originally had planned a year earlier, which was along the northern coast of Iceland. This is a fjord called Ólafsfjörður. And we drove up there at we arrived there about 3 in the morning. Sunrise was about at 4 a.m. And you can see it's quite a precipitous drop there. Looking to the due north, the northern sky, the sun was rising at a quite northerly azimuth. And there was a narrow slot in the sky where the sun rose. About 9/10 of the sky was cloud covered. So we watched anxiously as the sun rose into the slot and kept our fingers crossed that we would get to see the annular phase. About halfway through the partial phase, as the sun moved behind a narrow lenticular-shaped cloud and vanished for about a half hour. And we thought about packing up our equipment, but about 60 seconds before the annular phase, the sun slowly started emerging from this cloud deck. This is a video shot during that period. I've speeded it up about 10 times. But you'll see the annular phase emerge and appear out of the clouds. Very difficult to use filtration at this point. We couldn't use solar filters because you couldn't see anything through the filters. And through a telescope with a little bit more control, managed to get both contacts. And we were thrilled that we managed to see this in spite of the clouds. It was raining 10 minutes later, and it rained all the way back to Reykjavik. About 6 months later, we were at the opposite end of the Earth, this time for the second eclipse of the year. Both of these eclipses were retrograde eclipses in the sense that the shadow was moving across the Earth from east to west because the paths were on the opposite side of the pole, the sunward pole. And this time, as you saw Ahmed and Babak's wonderful movie, we were among the crew of Captain Kletnikov, which left out of South Africa. Had about 100 people on board. And the scenery along the way to Antarctica was spectacular. This is McDonald Island, where you're looking at an active volcano with some erupting smoke from the top of it, while down at the bottom, you're looking at a glacial tongue reaching down into the ocean. And the people on board, the crew who had been to McDonald's before, some of them had worked on McDonald Island, on a research base there. And the island is usually shrouded in clouds. And as we approached the island, the clouds actually parted. And this one researcher who had been there for about a year said he had never seen the top of the island before. It was such a rare opportunity to see it under these conditions. The wildlife was incomparable. It was like being immersed into the middle of a National Geographic movie. These were king penguins on the island of Crozet. This is, I think, the international sign of get back. You're too close. We did a cute term that they've got is flight scene. We had two helicopters aboard the Klebnikov, and we would take groups of four people and the pilot and fly above the icebergs. In this case, this is an iceberg graveyard, icebergs from the previous season that had been frozen into the sea ice. And we actually landed on the very edge of this with the pontoons of the helicopter looking straight down. The pilot did not shut the engine down, thank goodness, but it was quite breathtaking. You might think that life on a Russian icebreaker is tough. But let me tell you, the meals and the food and the service that we got, it was incredible. This little chocolate has the Quark emblem in embossed on it, and just give you a little sample of what the food was like on this cruise. Real pleasant surprise. None of us lost any weight at all. To the contrary. And it just seemed that every time you thought you had taken enough pictures of icebergs and ice, something else would show up where you'd expend some more pixels or some more film, much to the delight of Kodak and Fuji. The Adelie penguins were wonderful clowns on the ice. They accompanied us many times on our landings, and even on eclipse day, they joined me as I began setting up my equipment. We landed on an ice shelf. We were battling some problems with the weather. But at sunrise, the sky was spectacularly clear. Temperature was about minus 10 or minus 12 degrees centigrade. So quite mild for Antarctica. Unfortunately, as soon as the partial phases began, cloud deck reached the edge of the sun and started covering it, and we got intermittent views of the sun. This is a shot during totality where you can see the corona peeking out through a hole in the clouds with the Klebnikov in the foreground. So we did get some views of the corona and diamond ring. This is a shot by Pat of the corona. And this view was shot from the deck of the Klebnikov. I had a programmed Nikon up there that shot a frame approximately every 5 seconds, beginning about a minute before totality and running through a minute after totality. And the thing about it is I was able to take it, put it together into a QuickTime movie to animate the motion of the moon shadow sweeping over the scene and watching the clouds move. And it really illustrates what the sky looked like. It was very dramatic. We did not get a good view, as good a view of the corona as I would have liked, but the view of the sky and the lighting around us was spectacular. So let me start this little movie here. And you can see the corona pop out there for a few seconds. I'll let this loop through again. And watch the coloration and the change of the icebergs. So it was breathtaking. I spent at least half my time just looking around at the ice change. One final shot that was looking to the south as the shadow departed and looking at these incredible electric colors on the icebergs in the sky. Well, Athens has been much in the news as of late with the Olympics, but Pat and I will remember Athens this year for another reason. We chose that as our base of operations for the transit of Venus. We were about 70 miles southeast of Athens, along the Aegean coast, right by the Temple of Poseidon, built about 500 BC. And we had a group of about 40 people at a local hotel there, and had a great view of the transit. Remember, this was a southern transit of Venus across the disk that lasted over 6 hours. Notice the track here. And I took a sequence of photos every two and a half minutes or 5 minutes, I can't quite recall. But I mosaic them into a composite of the entire event. And I also took that same sequence and animated it. So in case 6 hours is a little too long, you can watch the transit now in about 15 seconds. And a bit of a close-up of the same thing. We had some clouds during the last hour or so of the transit. The sun would pop in and out of the clouds. Still managed to get a sequence of everything. But our best views of the contacts were first and second contact. Third and fourth were in and out of the clouds, so we didn't get a complete record of that. But again, here's a sequence of still frames. The cadence, the time interval changes once the transit, once ingress is complete, so Venus seems to rush along across the sun at that point. But it was one of the nicest annular eclipses I've ever seen. And our group posed up at the Temple of Poseidon at the end. Everybody was quite happy and already talking about 2012. Well, let's look forward a little bit. Before I get to the solar eclipses, I just want to mention that there is a nice lunar eclipse, which is always a good time to test some new equipment and see if things are operating. So this coming October, total eclipse is visible primarily from the U.S., but I think Western Europe gets a view of part of it as well, and the U.K. Got to make sure I always differentiate between Europe and the U.K. I keep on falling into conglomerations of that, and I get chastised quite often. In October of this year, there's also a partial eclipse. And most people aren't too interested in partial eclipses, but there's a few of us. And looking at the geometry of this partial, I realized it might be a good excuse for going to Hawaii, where you get a chance of seeing an approximately 50% eclipsed partial eclipse at sunset. I did this several years ago in Spokane for a sunset eclipse, and they're quite nice, and again, it's something to do in years when you don't have central eclipses. So Jake Pasikoff and Patrick Poitevin and Joanne and Vic and Jen Winter and a number of other people are going to have a mini convention in Honolulu in October. Well, let's get to central eclipses. The hybrid eclipse of April 2005 is the total portion of it, of course, is completely over ocean, the blue section on the graph here. You look at that a little more closely, and that annular portion means that it's most accessible from Tahiti or from the Galapagos, so there are several ships located from either of those points. The maximum duration is only 42 seconds at the center point. By the time the shadow reaches Panama and Costa Rica, it's already dropped down to annular phase, and the duration there is 10 to 15, 20 seconds or so. Annular eclipses of this type really can be quite stunning. This was an annular eclipse from 1984 that lasted about 15 seconds or so. And as you can see, there's heavy Bailey's beading around the entire limb, as well as a good view of the chromosphere. So I'm somewhat torn about this eclipse. I certainly want to see the total phase, but I also wish I could be two places at once and see the annular phase, this beaded annular phase along Panama and Costa Rica. Some more details of the path. I've got these images these maps on the website showing the path going through David near the northern limit and through Panama. Again, talking about this broken annularity type of an eclipse, I shot a sequence of photographs in Australia in 1999 of a very high magnitude annular eclipse. The magnitude was about 99.6%, I think. But this is a sequence of photographs taken without a solar filter. This is very similar to the circumstances that will take place in Panama. So if you're planning on going there, you might think about shooting a sequence without a solar filter, because you get a wonderful view of Bailey's beads, prominences, and even a little bit of the inner corona. You can see the edge of the moon is backlit by the corona in these images. Moving ahead, the annular eclipse of October 2005 is quite accessible, passing through the Iberian Peninsula and through Central Africa. A little close-up of the area. And we can see here both Portugal and Spain are in the path. Occurs in that part of the world early in the morning. The duration is a little over 4 minutes for the annular phase for tracks down across Africa. Most people, I expect, will be traveling to Spain or Portugal for the event, since it's drivable from most of the continent. But the one that most of us are really waiting for in the near future, of course, is the next major total eclipse in 2006. Now, this event is a member of CEROS 139, which holds special meaning for me because one of the earlier members of that series was the 1970 eclipse, which was my first total eclipse. The 1988 eclipse was a member of that, which passed through the Philippines. Another noteworthy eclipse of the series is in 2044, which passes through the central U.S. And the eclipse of 2186 is the peak duration member of this eclipse, which will produce a whopping 7.5 minutes, or a 7-minute and 29-second duration of totality. So start preparing for that eclipse now.
In your cottage.
Yeah. Another view of the 2006. Oh, I've got these out of order. Okay, it's another view of the 2006 eclipse with respect to the 2005. Some close-ups of probably the points where most people will be traveling for the 2006. This is northern Libya, and a lot of people will be coming into Tobruk and going down into, up here and coming down into the eclipse path from this position, or over from this location and down to Jalu, which is an oasis area, and perhaps from there a day trip down to the center line. This figure is one of the ones that Jay and I have been working on for the next eclipse bulletin, which is already 6 months late, but we're hoping it'll be finished up in about the next month and distributed by about maybe the end of September or sometime into October. I haven't had a chance to mention this to Patrick, surprise Patrick, but what I'd like to do is get the mailing list for everybody registered at this meeting, and they'll automatically get a copy of this. Now, a number of you are already on the mailing list. If you happen to get two copies, just pass one on to somebody else who would like a copy. Another map from the bulletin shows southern Turkey and the duration of totality from various points along the eclipse path. You'll notice, as Tom Van Flandern mentioned earlier, when you're in the central region of the eclipse, the duration doesn't change very much. You can really be quite a far distance off the central line and still get most of the duration. It's really when you get close to the edges where the duration drops very quickly. You can see that as the duration times bunch up, 1 minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes. Beyond total eclipse in 2006, there's an annular in September. Only landfall is in northern South America, French Guiana, and parts of Brazil. The annulars I'm not going to spend too much time on. I'm just going to mention them for completeness. This one, maybe not even any of the hardcore people in this room will bother with that one. An annular in Antarctica. But rule it out. It's early. It's a couple of years.
Not this far over any open basis on Antarctica.
Let me see. See, now you're going to get me thinking, Dan. Probably. I mean, the peninsula is filled with bases, and this is just shy of the peninsula. So one certainly could take one of these trips down from South America and see if you could dip down into the sunrise portion of the path, or it might be some. They might both be sunset. I don't know. Okay. 2008, another noteworthy eclipse coming up. This is a member of the same SARO series as the 1972 through Gaspé and Quebec in Canada. And the 1990 Jay Pasikoff and I saw from above Finland in a Finnair jet. This particular eclipse, Jay talked about the meteorology a little bit yesterday. It begins in northern Canada, but a very difficult, expensive place to get to, and the weather prospects very poor. The Quark Expedition company that organized the Klepnikov cruise is talking very seriously about two or three ships to do this cruise from this eclipse from the Arctic region. There are possibilities in northern Greenland or any place along this part of the track. You might do an excursion up to the pole combined with the eclipse trip. The biggest concern here is that the weather prospects in that part of the world are really poor. Things get better when you get down into northern Siberia and better into Mongolia and China, as Jay Saw showed us in his map yesterday. With still a reasonable duration of 2 minutes in Mongolia and China. Continuing on, 2009, another annular eclipse, not of too much interest. It's a fairly long annular eclipse, almost 8 minutes. But the major landfall in this case is in Indonesia in the late afternoon right before sunset. Now, Saros 136, the king of Saroses. The next major eclipse after the Mexico-Hawaii eclipse of 1991. I saw a predecessor in North Africa in 1973, so I'm very anxious to see the 2009 because that'll complete an exolimos for me, with three complete Saroses, to observe all three of them. Here we see, just briefly, this is the path of the 2008, and you can see the sunset point of 2008 comes close to the path of 2009. So you might go to the 2008 eclipse in Mongolia and China and combine it with a site inspection for 2009. But the path goes through India, Nepal, Bhutan, Myanmar, and China before hitting a couple little islands off the coast of Japan. I suspect that those little islands might sink with all the Japanese that go there. Quite a piece of real estate. But then it's pretty much over open ocean. There might be a couple little islands that it hits. I haven't looked into the details yet. But I think China looks like it might be the best option at this point. A lot of real estate to move around it, even though the weather prospects along most of the path aren't as nice as we would like them to be. But this is a good long 6 minute and 39 second eclipse from that in the Pacific. But even in China, it's 6 minutes plus. In 2010, although it's only an annular eclipse, it's an exceptional annular eclipse. with a duration of 11 minutes and 8 seconds in the Indian Ocean. It's the longest annular eclipse of the entire third millennium. It won't be superseded until 3080. And I look upon it as an excellent excuse to go back to East Africa and shoot some more wildlife and take in the annular eclipse while I'm there. 2010, again, mostly over the Pacific Ocean, which hits a little bit of land in southern Chile and Argentina. The problem here is that it occurs in July in near Patagonia, which is wintertime down there. So I suspect that the weather is very bad. The path does cross Easter Island. That's going to be a problematic area because there's a lot of us and not many hotels and real estate there. And I don't think the weather prospects there are terribly good. If Jay has something to say about that after we're done here. But in looking over the map, a schematic here, you'll notice that the Tahiti is just off the path of the eclipse. And this looks like it might be a good opportunity to do a cruise in this case out of Tahiti, where you have some mobility and can pick a place where the weather might be better. Any comment on that, Jay?
Well, certainly a good idea. I'm just sort of, that part of Patagonia is absolutely one of the most beautiful places in the world down there.
And the weather in July? Can I quote you?
Yeah, well, the stories of Alpine in there are just absolutely stunning.
Yeah.
But yeah, Tahiti is definitely going to be number one option after Easter Island is filled.
Yeah. Oh, I think Easter Island was filled in 2001. I think it's too late.
Yeah.
2012, another annular eclipse beginning in China across the Pacific. This time to us Yanks, we're interested because it passes over the western U.S. And if we take a look at that more closely, it goes right through northern Arizona and New Mexico, southern Utah, some gorgeous, gorgeous country there. Just hits the southern tip of Colorado.
Good weather at that time of year, too.
Yeah, nice weather.
You can do it in four states.
Yeah. If you stood at four corners, you could have 2 feet in, you know, you could alternate. You'd be in all four states during the year.
Also the height of tornado season, so you can do a little extra in there.
Yeah, we'll get Olivia involved in that, too. Next couple of clips is 2012. Basically, my strategy here is when I run out of time, I've got 20 more years worth of equipment, so we'll just arbitrarily stop at some point during the year. There's no way to time this. The SAROS 133 has the same eclipses as the 1976 through Australia and the 1994 through Central South America, Bolivia, Chile, and Peru. This one again, the eclipses in this coming decade, the next 10 years or so, have a perverse tendency to go over the Pacific with very little landfall. But it does start over northern Australia. That's the good news is it's northern Australia. The bad news is probably what Jay will say about the weather in northern Australia most of the time there. Yeah, very, very humid part of the world, Darwin. And it's also very early in the day. Might be another possibility to do some kind of cruise out of New Zealand for that. And you'll note here, this is the path of the 2002 eclipse, just for reference. And again, a view of the overall eclipse path of 2012, the total compared to the 2012 May eclipse. 2012 is notable because that's the next transit of Venus. Visibility, ingress is basically a North American and Pacific event, as well as Japan, and Eastern Australia, whereas egress, the sun will have set for North America, but Australia and most of Asia and Australia get a good view of it. I think Hawaii will get a chance to see the whole transit, so that might be a good opportunity to go back to Hawaii again. 2013, another annular eclipse. This one crossing some of the same real estate as the total in 2012. So if you've got a hankering to see an annular and a total from the same location, there's a chance. I think this would be a good opportunity to try a sunrise annular eclipse in Western Australia. 2013 is another hybrid eclipse. This one, although technically it's a hybrid eclipse, it's really a total eclipse with a little bit of annularity right at the beginning and the end. Because it's got a good, healthy 1 minute and 40 second maximum duration. Unfortunately, it's out in the ocean, not far from the coast, though. The 2014 eclipse, again, annular, Antarctica. What's next? It's a non-central eclipse. What I want to cover now, I've got a whole series of similar maps like that, but I thought it would be fun to look at some of the maps that are on the World Atlas of Solar Eclipse Paths that we've got on the NASA homepage. Thank you, Ralph. You can do little games with this stuff. If you zoom into one particular part of the world and look at a sequence of maps, the atlas covers 2000 BC to 3000 AD. I think the maps from 2000 BC to 1000 BC have to be taken with a grain of sand, grain of salt. Maybe a grain of sand. Because the value of delta T is really some hand waving, and the errors on the shifts of those paths are just indeterminate. It's very difficult. It's just a rough guide to look at where some of the eclipses take place with the best guess. But they're certainly open to revision any time. Anyway, if we look at the UK and the continent for the 20-year period 1981 through 2000, of course we've got the 1999 eclipse passing through here, hitting the southern UK. And you can ask yourself, when is the next total eclipse visible from the UK? And you can use the atlas to answer that very quickly. If you move forward in time to the next 20 years, 2001 to 2020, there's that really strange-shaped annular eclipse through Iceland and Scotland last year. 2015 eclipse, which I hadn't covered before, that goes up through Spitsbergen. Unfortunately, if we could move delta T a little bit more to get it through the continent, that would be nice. We've got the 2005 through Spain and the 2006 through Libya and Turkey, but none through the UK. Next 20 years, no good for the UK, but we do have a total eclipse going through Spain in 2026. That's only 22 years from now. But this is a real interesting confluence that you see in looking at these eclipse paths, because we have a total eclipse through Spain in 2026. 6 months later, a year and a half later, there's an annular eclipse in 2028. I missed this. And in 2027, 1 year after the 2026, is another total eclipse through Spain. So you've got a total eclipse 2026, a year later through the Gibraltar, and 6 months after that one, the annular. So Spain, for those of you who are looking for some real estate to retire on, that might be a nice sunny location. But alas, no totals in the UK. We look 20 years further, 2041 to 2060, still no luck, an annular through here. Yet another total eclipse through Gibraltar. And 2061 to 2080, no. 2081 to 2100, finally, good news at last. 2090, there we go, through southern UK, and another nice one through central Europe. That's the good news. The bad news is we'll all be dead. But it's an interesting exercise to look at. Well, I hope I've given you a little bit of inspiration to look forward to in the upcoming decade or two of eclipses. A lot of exciting opportunities and challenges to face, and more weather issues to skirt around and figure out. And I thank the organizers for inviting me to this wonderful meeting. Thank you.
One, that there is a big telescope, apparently a large telescope near Antalya, the National Observatory of Turkey, 1.5 meter telescope.
Yes.
Is there any science to do for the eclipse?
I have spoken a little bit to them, and I know they're planning to do some science, but I've been too busy with the predictions to really discuss what kind of science is being done. Jay, do you know anything about that? I don't know if Jay's here. Serge, you know?
Yeah, in 2006, at the eclipse of 2006, there will be the possibility to use the largest coronagraph in the world at Kislovodsk.
Okay. How large is it?
It's 55 centimeters.
Okay.
Aperture.
And that's in Turkey?
No, that's in still Russia.
Okay, in Russia.
In Georgia.
Oh,
close
boy.
To Georgia.
Well, if the coronagraph doesn't block the sun, the clouds will.
Yeah, just one little thing to add to the next weird transit. It will be, or it should be, visible from northern Europe. Mm-hmm. Well, if the clouds permit.
Ah, very northern Europe, yeah.